Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do something a little different. We're going to do an appreciation of Mencken, and I'm not going to take too awful long. There's activity involving noise going around where my atoms are presently congealed in the more or less immediate environment. So if you hear strange whappings and whackings, caterwaulings, that really doesn't have anything to do with me, but it's near enough me, it could be picked up. Enough whining, and without further ado, we're going to turn to my favorite book, which is The Vintage Mencken, gathered by Alastair Cook. Now, when I worked at The Spectator, we used to give this away as a premium for subscribing or resubscribing. It's got a yellow cover and a sort of a nearly pop-eyed, very, very light blue-eyed Mencken on the cover. He had the type of eyes you normally see in Irish, very, very light, pretty sort of blue eyes. He had a very round, but his face and his hairstyle looked German, even unto like a caricature almost. Big old ears, hair split down the middle, shortened, and then sort of shaved at the sides. And he surveys you openly without a trace of bitterness, hostility, or hatred. He's just looking at you, and he's got a cigar clamped in his lips. It says, running up the oddly way of doing it, a vintage book, K25, 95 cents in Canada. Now, this was assembled in, like, the 50s by Alastair Cook, who's an Englishman I don't know too much about. I'm going to skip his introduction. We'll deal with that later. I just want to talk about Mencken stuff directly and get right into it. I don't have a whole lot of time today. I'm not going to ramble on for hours. How many times have you heard me make that promise before? So we'll deal with the introduction at a later time. Anyway, this is a collection of his writings. He himself put together a Crestomathy, which is his selection, Mencken's selection of Mencken's best writings. This is simply gathered by Alastair Cook. It's just very good stuff, and I say this is my favorite book. It's about the right size of a book, 200, 250 pages. You can filter through it nimbly with your fingers. It doesn't oppress your palms with its heaviness. If you read it in the bath, or you read it lying on your back on a couch, you could put it on your chest without crushing yourself. And so you can filter through it and look at its pages and the marks on them. And it's delightful in the way that a book should be delightful. And mine is particularly delightful because A, it's old, and B, I've taped it up so there's tape all over it. And tape feels really good running it under your fingers. So it's a physical, visual pleasure before we even just step inside and see what's going on. Now, Mencken is, and I'm hardly alone in this, one of the reasons I became a writer, or the type of writer that I did, was because I so enjoyed the way that he used words to inflict pain and create joy in people through summaries and descriptions. And he considered himself a critic of ideas, and I do too, I guess, to an extent. A good extent. I'm more partisan and very different from him in some ways, but hopefully some of the joyful aspects of it and the joy of criticism is there, or is common. But anyway, turning to page 3, we'll just go through a little bit until I get tired of talking. We'll go through a couple of these little snips. Some of these articles are longer. Some of them are his famous ones. Some of them are just little chops out of his work, whatever Alastair Cook thought was good. And I think he did a really good job of selecting them. He's got stuff about William Bryant and Prohibition and judges stuff from Mencken's biographical work. Just fantastic stuff about men and women, the sexes, their differences. Anyway, first up, Introduction to the Universe, 1883. From Happy Days. This is some of the biographical stuff he wrote when he was older. Mencken ended his life. He was considered the most one of the Jews who was more or less in the same line of work as Mencken said. He was the most influential private person of I forget whatever the time period was, the first quarter or half of the 20th century. He wrote for the Smart Set, American Mercury, a couple of magazines that he either started or founded. And they were quite the thing in the 20s. It was kind of the center of his fame, and it faded somewhat under FDR, and it got a little, people didn't like him as much during the bad times, and he was very anti-Roosevelt for good reasons that hold up well today. Usually today, Mencken would be said that he's tainted by his anti-Semitism, but the fact that, of course, is not of course, but that claim is actually the reverse of the truth. If anything, he wasn't anti-Jew enough, because he underestimated the power of these, he called Jewish communists a bunch of kittens sitting around a table in New York City, and he underestimated, if anything, the misery that they would cause. But in his private stuff and somewhat in his public stuff, he definitely acknowledged that Jews were quite probably the most repulsive race ever heard of, and that there's very good reason to hate them. And he said the Talmud, he said, "I am one of the few goyim who ever tackled the Talmud, and you shall now expect that I'll say it's a great work of deserving of great study by others." He said, "Unfortunately, I must differ from such expectation. It seems to me it is a matter largely of rubbish." You don't see people talking like that today, but he really truly was the most, I think, the best writer in English that has ever existed. But no doubt that is partly because of my taste. He does it the right way, and you'll notice he never went to college. He went to Baltimore Polytechnic, so a high school, and yet he knows more than, you know, 1,000 college graduates put together, and he never was deformed by having to write stupid essays to length, pushing absurd points of view, as anyone who's been to college has been forced to. And he also, as a newspaperman, had a very wide scope and talked to all kinds of people, and he knew all kinds of people in the church. He had a lot of friends. He was kind of a hypochondriac. He knew a lot of doctors. So he would very often draw his analogies and his metaphors from the world of medicine. But anyway, Introduction to the Universe, 1883. "At the first instant, I became aware of the cosmos." And I'm going to pause it after every word almost. The particular joy is not that he's critical, not that he's hilarious when he's being critical, not that he's being vicious or what people consider vicious. It's merely acute honesty a lot of times, or a way of looking at something that they don't find flattering or pleasant. But it's the most glorious thing in the world if you like it. And just the way that he uses words is like a continual sub-orgasm, I guess is the way I would put it. And if you have that, it's almost, and this is a new thing that somehow I came across, I saw it on the internet and I was looking. Now people, I forget the name, but it's some kind of thing where like a very light, whispery kind of voice will set off pleasurable sensations in your head. And this is now like a thing where they deliberately try to stoke this feeling by having these women do videos like a mock hair cutting, and they do the whole thing with a whisper, and then you hear the effects of the comb, and it's, or they scratch their long nailed fingers along a box, stuff like that, to create these little frisons of pleasure in your head and relax and soothe you. It's some weird thing. It's like ASMDR or something like that. I watched a couple of videos and then I started feeling kind of perverted, but weird. Anyway, it's not precisely that type of pleasure, but it's somewhat similar in that, like coffee-colored coffee ice cream. It's not like a super strong flavor, but it's better than just sort of vanilla. I don't think vanilla is all that great, but it's better. It's subtle. But it's continual. That's what's so great about it. It doesn't peak. Well, it peaks when he comes up with something extraordinary that just delights you beyond measure. That might be orgasmic, but just the average sort of word music that he's able to compose is very, very nice. If you, again, can sense it, you can feel the rhythm of it. And I'll explain it as we go along. This is the reason Varga asked me to talk about this. I haven't talked about it because a lot of this is, I mean, you just appreciate it, but you can discuss the technical aspects of it if you're a writer, and even if you're not a writer, you can perhaps understand some of it, but the basic glory of it is doesn't really need explanation, I don't think. There's a reason. Mencken, I'm hardly alone in being inspired by him. Maybe today he's a little farther away from people than they used to be. But he inspired all kinds of people in the way he inspired me. So that's absolutely common. And like Nietzsche said, you choose your father. So in your professional career, your capacity, or what you spend your time doing, you need to choose good people. And Mencken is as good as they get. I disagree with him on some ideas, but in the main, I follow the way that he looks at things. Although his thing, he was not pushing racial stuff, but he was more... Every school tries to claim him as their own. The libertarians will try to claim him. The leftist will even try to claim him because they'll say he was a radical and a rebel. And he was. He was not a conservative in the sense of these patriotards. Indeed, he was oppressed by the forerunners of the patriotards because he spoke out against our involvement in the wars. And the 100% Americans who were basically earlier sorts of Sarah Palins were running around the country beating up German nationals where they might come across them and denouncing German cultural waste. There used to be a whole sort of German culture in America of gymnasiums and beer gardens and other stuff, and it was kind of drummed out by the same idiots who would like rename French fries if the French wouldn't go along with our WMD lie-based war campaigns. It was the same thing back then. They would rename, you know, dachshunds and stuff like that. Just typically stupid Anglo-Saxonism of the kind that proliferates in the U.S. And he did actually write a whole letter denouncing Anglo-Saxons. We'll get to that later, but not today. So he was by no means and he often compares whites unfavorably to blacks. But the key thing was he said what he thought was right, and he usually had pretty good evidence to back it up. So his basic distinction was not racial so much as he observed the nasty side of all kinds of people, both sexes, all races. He even dared to criticize Jews, although he criticized Jews less than others, but if you want to look at it and add it up mathematically. But of course, it's only his criticism of Jews that ever gets pointed out. But he did criticize. A lot of people say that, oh, they take on all these people equally. They don't. Well, he really did. In fact, the only people that were more or less he criticized less were probably his own Germans. And of course, he would have felt, because he was even prevented from writing for his own paper, he would have felt that there was enough of that going around. I mean, when they're going around harassing people and beating them up, real stuff that happened, as opposed to stuff when the Jews say there was pogroms against the Jews, there was stuff that didn't even really happen or that they deserved because they were trying to foment a miserable revolution, which is what they did in the Soviet Union. Anyway, we're gonna look at this from a writer's point of view and a reader's point of view and explain what's so great about it. But we're not explaining to explain it away the way a leftist does. We're explaining it to enhance our appreciation because great men exist, great writers exist, great human beings, great men and women exist, and they can't be explained away as matters, as texts. That's so disrespectful, as texts that are products of social forces and times. That, my friends, is bullshit, and that's what they try to teach in any institution dominated by leftists, like public school or colleges. No, greatness is a very real thing. And Mencken was one of the greatest. And again, he's unusual. Another part of the unusualness of his background is he doesn't come from, he's not Irish at all. He's not Jewish. He doesn't come from any kind of a publishing background or really any kind of an intellectual background. His parents, as we're going to hear, were his dad was in cigars and wanted Mencken to follow him, but his dad happened to die right when he was kind of coming of age, and he just went down to the newspaper office and just stood there coming back, and finally they hired him. From there, he went to great fame because he had an incredible facility for writing and editing and was naturally great at it. And let that be a lesson to any of you reading. If you're good enough at someone, find the best in that field. Study what they did. Study how they achieved their effects. And just go do it yourself and whatever that requires. If that requires you go find where the great master is and sit at their side and study for them for free or while you do something else to pay your bills or whatever, that's what you got to do. There's always a way to get something done. No one who truly wants to do something is going to be stopped by such modest providential and bodily concerns as we all have. So don't whine in this life. Just do what needs to be done. Do what you can do. You know, like they say, if you think you can do it or you think you can't, you're right. And that's how it is. Make it happen. Make it work. Don't whine. Anyway, greatest book ever. It's just put together the way a book should be. Now, Introduction to the Universe. At the first instant, or at the instant I first became aware of the cosmos we all infest, I was sitting in my mother's lap. Again, notice what's distinct. The cosmos we all infest. You see? What infest? Vermin, insects, worms. Already you have a clue. In the very first line, you have a clue to how he thinks of people or how he thinks it funny to depict people. Isn't that glorious? Because other people won't say it like that. But don't you see how inherently funny that is? Again, this is why I've never talked about it, because you can't explain to people if they don't pick up that the guy is saying that we infest the cosmos. He's winking at you when he's writing. That's what's glorious about it. You see how I like him and I like Dahl? It's the same thing. They're always winking at you. They're always telling you little fibs or falsehoods or putting out an alternative way of looking something that makes you think, fuck, never thought about it like that. There's the gloriousness of it. The glory of it. That's why you do it. That's what attracts me about certain types of writing. I don't like to pile up nice, appropriate words into agreeable, functional sentences. And then, you know, that's marketing literature. It's perfect, perfected. This is, there has to be some ribaldry and some eye-openingness to it to make it wonderful. Again, if you're in this vein, a lot of people are not in this vein, but if for people who are in this vein, Mencken would be the top, and Twain's more or less in this vein. Schopenhauer is in this vein, not with the humor so much as the kind of oblique or slanted observations. You know, the opposite of the up with people is to say that people infest the universe. Now, see, we've gone 17 minutes, and we're precisely 10 words into this. You see? So, well, I am. I do have stuff to do today. I cannot go on and on for 5 or 6 hours. But you know what? The point here is, see, I was moving or something, or moving books around. I've read this book probably 50, 75 times, more than any other book. Whereas there's only a handful of movies I've seen more than once. I would, you know, whenever I was lying around, if I happened to see this book, say I'm walking around and I see it on a shelf, I would grab it and lie down. Just every time I'd be tempted to sit down and just reread some of these essays and appreciate the way that he uses language, because you don't find others like that. At the instant I first became aware, and this is from Happy Days, 1940. So Mencken had his great career as a newspaper man, started a couple of kind of cool magazines, and then wrote just a whole bunch of books. A lot of his books are really collections, though. But eventually he had a kind of a stroke, more or less, and was incapacitated for the last 8 years of his life, which was a real tragedy. Another tragedy, he married a woman that he met giving a lecture at Goucher College, and he was loyal to her, but she was young, but she got super sick and died, so he never really had a family. But so he had some tragedies as well, as we all do. But before he had his stroke, which is about 1948, and then he died in like 56, I think it was, the last few professional years before then, he worked on his American language. He really had compiled a monumental volume of how English is actually used in America, and was considered to be probably the top expert in that field. Again, this is a person who has a high school education, formally. So all the nitwits, the titwits are always, education is a word forever on the lips of idiots. It's learning that you should be after. And learning is free. before that, he not only he worked on his revising his volume of American the American language, it was called, but also he wrote some of his works about his biography and memoirs, and they were very, very popular. And you'll often find those books floating around in used bookshops. At the instant I first became aware of the cosmos we all infest, think George Carlin, that people are a skin disease on the earth, save the earth. Where do you think, you know, we talk about originality when we talk about this stuff, and the way that someone who's a profound spark, say the 1 in 20, who can be a cultural producer or a spark of new ideas amidst the 19 of 20 who are repeaters, which is nothing wrong with that, but people like George Carlin, you often wonder, he was an older comedian, now dead, you know, he would talk about how you're going to, making fun of people are going to save the earth, and he would say, look, humans are just a skin disease, man's been around for, the earth has been around forever, we've been here for maybe 1% of the time, it'll slough us off like a nasty rash. And you wonder that if they would get an idea like that, this is a more distant possibility that he would get an idea like that from reading a great like Macon talking about humans infesting the atmosphere, and put his mind to work and think how he could revise or emend or apply that in a slightly different area. This is how most originality works. You see, at the instant I first became aware of the cosmos we all infest, I was sitting in my mother's lap and blinking at a great burst of lights. Some of them red and others green, but most of them only the bright yellow of flaring gas. Remember, this is a century plus ago. The time, the evening of Thursday, September 13th, 1883, which was the day after my third birthday. So he was born in 1880, say 9 years before Hitler, and right at the period when America began opening up to Southeastern Europe for immigration, bringing in all the Jews. So he's sitting there watching lights the day after his third birthday. The place, a ledge outside the second story front windows of my father's cigar factory at 368 Baltimore Street, Baltimore, Maryland, USA, fenced off from space and disaster by a sign bearing the majestic legend, August Mencken and Brother. The occasion, the third and last annual Summer Nights Carnival of the Order of Orioles. So the Baltimore Order of Orioles, a society that adjourned sine die, the next day, I think that is, with a thumping deficit the very next morning. A society that joined sine die with a thumping deficit the very next morning and has since been forgotten by the whole human race. At that larval stage of my life, of course, I knew nothing whatever about the Order of Orioles. Now, you've seen me use larval 1,000 times. Where do you think I got it from? I got it from there because it's so striking. Again, that's the second time. Just as in the first paragraph, he used infest. Now he used larval again. It's always funny, and you learn as you're studying and learning comedy. You instinctively, what's so instinctively funny about that, comparing humans to insects? And then you think, well, what other ways? You could call them pupil or whatever, but larval has a particular oral quality that makes it endlessly amusing. At that larval stage of my life, of course. And again, who else would use it like that? No one would use it like that because they all feel they need to be proper and respectful and dignified. And they get that a lot of that from Christianity, which is why you don't find funny stuff generally coming from Christians. You don't find a single joke in the entire Bible. It's only the atheist, generally, not only, but generally it's the atheist who have actual individuated personalities, the people like Mencken and Twain, because they dare to laugh, they dare to think, they dare to present things differently. And that, and in them, it's not a cheap evasion of the sometimes tedious process of coming to understand the rules of spelling and grammar, explication, and such. It's that they aren't overly bound by the demands of respectability in the way that others are. At that larval stage of my life, of course, I knew nothing whatever about the order of Orioles, just as I knew nothing whatever about the United States, though I had been born to their liberties and was entitled to the protection of their army and navy. And again, you see how funny that is? I knew nothing whatever about the United States, though I had been born to their liberties and I was entitled to the protection of their army and navy. He's having fun. He's winking at you. All I was aware of, emerging from the unfathomable abyss of non-entity, was the fact that the world I had just burst into seemed to be very brilliant, and that peeping at it over my father's sign was somewhat hard on my still gelatinous bones. So I made signals of distress to my mother and was duly hauled into her lap, where I first dozed and then snored away until the lights went out and the family buggy wafted me home, still asleep. Again, that's as good as writing gets, in my view. The unfathomable abyss of non-entity. Think of the prosaicness of what he's describing, and think of how he described it so coolly and interestingly. Right? You're like, oh. He had just been born, and he describes it as emerging from the unfathomable abyss of non-entity. Again, the mock heroic, or the ironic, or the wry, or the just, but not in the hard sense. Just in the light sense, he's being very modestly sort of ribbing the typical presentation of how he was born, and not feeling the need to be dignified, respectable, but just to be getting the funny gloriousness and weirdness of existence, communicating that through the prose. Very subtle, but pleasurable. See, it's pleasurable to read all I was aware of emerging, and you think of this, him being a fat baby sitting on his parents' lap, seeing all these starburst explosions. All that I was aware of emerging from the unfathomable abyss of non-entity was the fact that the world I had just burst into seemed to be very brilliant, and that peeping at it over my father's sign was somewhat hard in my still gelatinous bones. Isn't that good? Gelatinous. You can learn a hell of a lot of vocabulary from Mencken. And this is the thing. Had the guy had no formal education, he knows more words than anyone you're going to come across. This side of maybe Revelo Oliver. Peeping at it over my father's sign was somewhat hard in my still gelatinous bones, so I made signals of distress. See? And doesn't that totally, can't you totally picture him wriggling in the way that they do? Rather than saying, I started crying, you know, in the boring, typical way, he says, I made signals of distress to my mother and was duly hauled. Again, you'll notice when I write, I use that sort of way of putting it also. Duly, in the sense that he does, hauled into her lap, where I first dozed and then snored away until the lights went out and the family buggy wafted me home, still asleep. And it's always funny, he would always use off words for everything, but for cars, calling them flivvers, or Peruna for, I think, Coke, or for the road, I forget which. Anyway, that ends that selection. That's his description of his coming to consciousness. We'll just do one more, a few pages. And that was very, very brief. The Baltimore of the 80s, the 1880s, that is, of course, from Happy Days, 1940, he wrote kind of a trilogy of memoirs. The city into which I was born in 1880 had a reputation all over for what the English, in their real estate advertising, are fond of calling the amenities. So far as I have been able to discover by a labored search of contemporary travel books, no literary tourist, however waspish he may have been about Washington, Niagara Falls, the prairies of the West, or even Boston and New York, ever gave Baltimore a bad notice. They all agreed, often with lubricious gloats and gurgles. Again, that's pleasurable. A, that its indigenous victualry was unsurpassed in the Republic. That its native Caucasian females of all ages up to 35 were of incomparable pulchritude and as amiable as they were lovely. C, that its home life was spacious, charming, full of creature comforts, and highly conducive to the facile and orderly propagation of the species. Again, this is, to me, this is as good as it gets. Because it's funny. Is there enough love in the world? Probably not, but I don't miss it. Is there enough humor in the world? No, there's not, and I do miss it. And Mencken has it in supply far more than any other writer. And it's maybe mild that people don't all appreciate it, but lubricious. Listen, just alone to the words, you would have to know to understand this. Lubricious. What does that mean? Vittlery. Have you ever used that word? V-I-C-T-U-A-L. Like, it's pronounced vittles. Vittlery. Vittlery. You wouldn't even think to use that in the nominal form. You'd only ever see it. And its indigenous vittlery was unsurpassed in all the Republic. Again, mock, heroic, grandiose. That its native Caucasian females of all ages up to 30. Again, notice the flip. He's like, of all ages up to 35. It's like, it's the effect of like one of those asterisks that the fine print at the bottom kind of defines it a tad more closely circumscribed than the grandiose rhetoric suggests. Oh, they have the most beautiful women up to 35. We're of incomparable pulchritude, right? Do you know what pulchritude means? Can you guess from the context that it means beauty? But see, you're always using the expensive, the long, multi-syllabled Latinate word, but not in a ponderous, pretentious, I'm important way that the middle class uses it. Again, Paul Fussell in class says that the multiplication of multiple syllabification is one of their favorite things, so that they are always in need of something rather than just needing it. Always and the bank process rather than just the thing itself. The death process, the dying process rather than just dying. Anyway, when Mencken does it, it's always for subtle comedic effect. So back then, the writers always... already you've had two excellent vocabulary words that you could use if you knew them. Lubricious. Pulchritude. He's talking about reviewers gloating and gurgling again like a baby. See, this would be the language that would be considered, it's undignified to present people like that. It may be, but it's funny. He's not writing to please the respectable crowd and using the approved formulations so dear to the ears of the women, the middle class, and idiots of women of both sexes and the middle class. He's writing something that's different and better. Its home life was spacious, charming, full of creature comforts, and highly, again, it's the way, it's not so much what he says here, it's the way he says it, highly conducive to the facile and orderly propagation of the species. And you think, what does that mean? It's odd. It's funny. There was some truth in all these articles, but not, I regret to have to add, too much. Perhaps the one that came closest to meeting scientific tests was the first. Again, listen to how he describes this. Baltimore lay very near the immense protein factory of Chesapeake Bay, and out of the bay it ate divinely. Isn't that a cool way to put it? And it doesn't the writer have some job to entertain as well as instruct and amuse and enlighten and thrill the reader? If not, why is he writing? I mean, it's one thing if you're compiling a handbook, the textbook of carpentry and screws or something. You don't need to be funny, but I mean, this is so good that I can't, and this is why I haven't talked, I can't explain to you why it's good, other than to say that who else would have put it like this? And isn't that a cool and memorable way to think about it? The river, the Chesapeake, at first, he uses a couple of metaphors. It's like a factory for producing protein, like delicious little crabs and turtles running around, waiting to make their appearance in your soup. And Baltimore eats out of this Chesapeake Bay. Have you ever been out there and seen it? I remember I used to live out there and work out there. And oh my God, we went out to one of our upper bosses had a party. We all went out there and we went around on their wave runners and crashed, and there were all kinds of jellyfish in there and we got stung by them. It was kind of terrible, but a lovely location the Chesapeake is, and blue crabs is the thing that Maryland's famous for. They're delicious. Anyway, Baltimore lay very near the immense protein factory of the Chesapeake Bay. And see, once you read that, you will tend to remember that, a protein factory, thinking of the, it's very, it sets off a little burst in your mind, a protein. Interesting way to think of it. and ate out of the bay. It ate, and you have that out, in, up. You feel that in the pros. Baltimore, very, okay, you're at Baltimore up, lay very near the immense protein factory of the Chesapeake Bay, down and out of the bay, also down. It ate divinely, back up. I don't know. There actually is a Greek term for this and for every single literary technique that exists, but most of the terms are not memorable at all, like onomatopoeia, that kind of thing. But you needn't know them so long as you can produce them. If you're a real writer, you can appreciate them and feel them and see how others use this stuff and learn. And if you're innately able to do it yourself, it will further you in that line. If you're mediocre, you can perhaps learn to copy it in a rather stilted way. But the basic thing here is to appreciate it. And again, the reason I haven't talked, if you can't appreciate it, if you don't feel what I'm saying, then I can't really teach you to appreciate it. But this is greatness, and it should be acknowledged. Baltimore lay very near the immense protein factory of the Chesapeake Bay, and out of the bay it ate divinely. I well recall, and again, it's just appreciation. The reason people like these books is things were better then. And he has some, oh, I even know it's coming up, and my freaking balls are tingling for what he's going to say ahead. It's just wonderful. I well recall the time when prime hard crabs of the channel species, blue in color, prime hard crabs, blue in color, at least 8 inches in length along the shell and with snow-white meat, almost as firm as soap. Isn't that an interesting way to put it? We're hawked in Holland Street. That's where he lived, of a summer mornings at 10 cents a dozen. The supply seemed to be almost unlimited, even in the polluted waters of the Patapsco River, which stretched up 14 miles from the bay to engulf the slops of the Baltimore canneries and fertilizer factories. Any poor man could go down to the banks of the river armed with no more than a length of stout cord, a homemade net on a pole, and a chunk of cat's meat. Ooh, that's interesting, and it's just you're reading the specifics and peculiarities of a time that may be in your own country and even somewhere you've lived or visited, and it's so different. And he records it so memorably and precisely. A homemade length of stout cord, a homemade net on a pole, and a chunk of cat's meat, and come home in a couple of hours with enough crabs to feed his family for 2 days. Soft crabs, of course, were scarcer and harder to snare, and hence higher in price, but not much. More than once, hiding behind my mother's apron, I helped her to buy them at the door for 2½ 12 cents apiece. 2 12 cents apiece. And there blazes in my memory like a comet the day she came home from Holland's Market. This is what I was referring to. Complaining with strain from Holland's Market, she comes back from Holland's Market complaining with strange and bitter indignation that the fishmongers there, including old Harris, her favorite, had begun to sell shad roe. Hitherto, stretching back to the first settlement of Baltimore Town, they had always thrown it in with a fish as a kind of a lagniappe. Worse, she reported that they had now entered upon an illegal combination to lift the price of the standard shad of 20 inches, enough for the average family, and to spare from 40 cents to half a dollar. When my father came home from lunch and heard this incredible news, he predicted formally that the Republic would never survive the 19th century. Now that is a... I've used this, actually, I think I used this once as an example. When my father came home, the word that makes that sentence, he predicted formally. That's humor. That's as good as humor gets. He predicted formally. Like, you get the self-important bourgeois. If you know how they are, a lot of older, middle-aged white males tend to be this. They can't hear anything, and they're very sure of their convictions, and you get just a little taste of that in this. He predicted formally. You know, from high to low in that way. And just he's writing about a very small thing as though it's a very great thing. And that's one of the standard techniques for producing humor. Because most people write about small things as though they're great things without realizing that's what they're doing. Because they're very self-important and self-involved. Or they have great respectability fears, as most middle-class people do. For fear of falling out of the middle class by virtue of not following the approved ways of doing things. It's all very funny if you have eyes to see it. And again, to me, that's as good as it gets. I mean, worse, she reported, they have all entered upon an illegal combination to lift the price of the standard shad of 20 inches from 40 cents to half a dollar. And again, he's using the language of high to describe low. He's, remember, this is the time of the trusts and the trust busters, and he's using the language of something like Standard Oil trying to monopolize oil, or banks coming together to monopolize banking through a cartel, to describe the simple raise in price of these cheap little fish shad. And you see that again is the funny part. Now we move on. Terrapin was not common eating in those days any more than it is in these. Again, terrapin rather than turtle. But that was mainly because few women liked it, just as few like it today. It was then assumed that their distaste was due to the fact that its consumption involved a considerable lavage with fortified wines. Again, but they still show no honest enthusiasm for it, though prohibition converted many of them into very adept and eager boozers. See, again, the use of words. Boozers, lavage. The concept that outlawing liquor turned a lot of women into big fans of it. What? Things intended overtly to promote one end actually produce and promote another end? How can that be? So you see how all this fits together? The high versus the low. The low presented in terms of the high. The one presented in formal terms versus the reality. And contrasting them and using marvelous language to do all of this with a jaunty, sprightly sort of tone. Do you know what lavage means? I'm not going to define these words for you very often. I'm asking you, do you know what lavage means? Do you have a feeling you might know more if you did know what it means? Though prohibition converted many of them into very adept and eager boozers. It's one of his favorite nouns is adepts. Which I don't copy because but he is one who used that repeatedly. There he uses it as an adjective, but he will use adepts as a noun commonly. It was not in my infancy. Again, we're talking about terrapin here. Within the reach of the proletariat, but it was certainly not beyond the bourgeoisie. My mother, until well past the turn of the century, used to buy pint jars of the pickled meat in Holland's market with plenty of rich golden eggs scattered through it for a dollar a jar. For the same price, it was possible to obtain two wild ducks of respectable, if not royal, species. And the open season ran gloriously from the instant the first birds wandered in from Labrador to the last stragglers set to sail, till the last stragglers set sail for Brazil. So far as I can remember, my mother never bought any of these ducks, but that was only because the guns, dogs, and eagle eye of my Uncle Henry, who lived next door, kept us oversupplied all winter. So the Menkins were hunters as well as cigar makers. Garden truck, again, the unusual word to describe produce, right? He doesn't say vegetables or produce. He says garden truck. Truck being matter, material, or food. Was correspondingly cheap, and so was fruit in season. Out of season, we seldom saw it at all. You think back, I've mentioned before, and I know this is not just my family living here in Kirksville back in my dad's time, but they would get oranges for Christmas in their stockings. Oranges were a Christmas treat because, you know, they have to be grown somewhere else and shipped a long way to get to you, and not everyone has a lot of money to afford things, but maybe they could get an orange at Christmas. So oranges, which cost 60 cents a dozen, came in at Christmas and not before. And he's saying they seldom saw a fruit out of season. We had to wait until May and see if we were leftist, they would say, like, this is like on the ground type of history of the what actually went on, rather than the history of the mighty nobles and the high-end political church stuff of the time. This is like the living man's history. But We had to wait until May for strawberries, asparagus, fresh peas, carrots, and even radishes. But when the huge, fragrant strawberries of Anne Arundel, pronounced Anne Ranel, appeared at last, they went for only 5 cents a box. All spring, the streets swarmed with hucksters selling such things. They called themselves not hucksters, but Arabs, as in street Arabs, with the first A as day, so Arabs. They called themselves hucksters selling fruit, called themselves Arabs, and announced their wares with loud, raucous, unintelligible cries, much worn down by phonetic decay. Again, the excellence of the description there. What a phonetic decay. What does that mean? Why would he think to describe it that way? Loud, but when he says loud, raucous, unintelligible cries, don't you know exactly what he means? You do. In winter, the principal howling. Again, he's always using words that are more commonly used to describe animals and their behavior, the noises they emit, than are commonly used for respectable middle-class humans. And that is partly what makes him so delightful. In winter, the principal howling was done by colored men selling shucked oysters out of huge cans. In the dark, backward, and abysm of their time, their cry must have been simply, "Oysters!" But generations of Afro-American larynxes had debased it to, "Arnie!" But the final E is pronounced until the vendor got out of breath. So they're screaming this unintelligible niggerish, "Arnie!" for oysters. He always wore a blue and white checked apron, and that apron was also the uniform of the colored butlers of the Baltimore gentry when engaged upon their morning work, sweeping the sidewalk, scouring the white marble front steps, polishing up the handle of the big front door, and bragging about their white folks to their colleagues to port and starboard, that is, to left and right. So that's how blacks acted like back then. They were proud of the particular white family they served and thought it better than others. Oysters were not too much esteemed in the Baltimore of my youth, nor are they in the Baltimore of today. They were eaten, of course, but not often, for serving them raw at the table was beyond the usual domestic technique of the time, and it was difficult to cook them in any fashion that made them consonant with contemporary ideas of elegance. Use of consonant there, outside of verbal stuff or language or rhetoric. It's interesting. And also the usual domestic technique of the time. Rather than saying people didn't really, most women didn't know how to prepare them, he says it was beyond the usual domestic technique of the time. It's just a cooler way of saying it. He always has, invariably, as a cool, different, and original way of saying something. It's like the way Shakespeare does, except it's funny. Where Shakespeare is rarely, rarely funny. Although he's often ribald in the way that Mencken also is. Fried, they were fit only to be devoured at church oyster suppers, or gobbled. Again, he doesn't hesitate to use rougher animal language to describe humans. He seems to glory in it in a way that really, basically, it traces back to Rabelais, although it doesn't really come from him. Rabelais was a French doctor writing in the 1500s, I believe. And a priest as well. Perhaps the only funny Christian who ever existed. And I have a feeling that Mencken read him all. I can't think of any direct connection, but he would write about things more or less in the way Mencken is writing here, although, you know, that was a very different time and place. But so oysters fried, they were fit only to be devoured at church oyster suppers or gobbled in oyster bays by drunks wandering home from scenes of revelry. The more celebrated oyster houses of Baltimore, for example, Kelly's in Utah Street, EUTAW Street, were patronized largely by such lamentable characters. It was their playful custom to challenge the foolish-looking stranger to wash down a dozen raw chicoteagues of pony fame with a half tumbler of Maryland rye. The town belief was that this combination was so deleterious as to be equal to the kick of a mule. Again, just the rhythm of the sentence is perfect. It's perfect. It delights you. It doesn't matter what he's describing. It's delightful. It delights your Wortgefühl, your word feeling. That's a bogus German word I made up because it sounds right. Okay. I mean, just feel it. The more celebrated oyster houses of Baltimore, for example, Kelly's in Utah Street, were patronized largely by such lamentable characters, that is, the drunks wandering home from scenes of revelry. It was their playful custom to challenge foolish-looking strangers to wash down a dozen raw Chicatees oysters with a half-tumbler of Maryland rye. The town belief was that this combination was so deleterious as to be equal to the kick of a mule. If the stranger survived, they tried to inveigle him into eating another dozen with sugar sprinkled on them. This dose was supposed to be almost certainly fatal. I grew up believing that the only man in history who had ever actually swallowed it and lived was John L. Sullivan, as a famous boxer in the times. And you see again how he's always constantly, and he gets this from Twain, from Schopenhauer, he's mocking humanity, and he's mocking beliefs. He's not willing to accept things at face value. He's reporting the local customs, but he's ribbing them and making fun of them. And he's just showing you how people have these fervent beliefs and things. Of course, they don't actually believe that stuff's going to kill you, but you can see how this one applied to more serious political matters. You can see that where he will spot the difference. He will live in the area between the appearance and the reality. That's where the humor and the truth are. There's a saying in Baltimore that crabs may be prepared in 50 ways and that all of them are good. And see, the quintessential Baltimore experience, at least when I lived there, is, yeah, you go to a crab restaurant and they spread out brown paper, give you a mallet, and then they give you a big thing of beer. And you drink a bunch of beer, and you smack the crabs with the mallet and eat them, and you're there with all your friends, your business colleagues, and it's just freaking wonderful. Maryland is a good, good state. There's a saying in Baltimore that crabs may be prepared in 50 ways and that all of them are good. The range of oyster dishes is much narrower, and they are much less attractive. Fried oysters I have just mentioned. Stewed, they are undoubtedly edible, but only in the sorry sense that oatmeal or boiled rice is edible. Certainly no Baltimorean, not insane, would argue that an oyster stew has any of the noble qualities of the two great crab soups, shore style with vegetable, and bisque with cream. Certainly no Baltimorean, not insane, would argue that an oyster stew has any of the noble qualities. And again, one of his favorite words. Oh, and again, notice how he's applying noble, something noble, to something as lowly as a fish concoction, as a stew of something out of the water. See, again, the high mixed with the low, or the high used to set off the low, or the high used to mock the low, or the high used appropriately, because he really does believe this soup is noble. He liked to eat, and he's actually using it accurately there. But if he's saying humans are not noble, but things like this actually are noble, and he's bringing it out. And so you'll notice that's another thing I use from him. I use noble a lot myself, like I use larvae. But the jaunty spirit that comes naturally to him, and he's without the viciousness that I often exert. But he has the same high. He has a high spiritedness, and it's just wonderful. Anyway, so he says both of these masterpieces were on tap in the old Rennert. R-E-N-N-E-R-T. Remember, Baltimore back then had a German section. Rennert Hotel, when I lunched there daily, years after the term of the present narrative. And both were magnificent. That is, the bisque style crab soup and the shore style crab soup. With bisque is that creamy sort of, think tomato soup with some milk poured in it type thing. With crab versus the other way. Both of these masterpieces were on tap in the old Rennert Hotel when I lunched there daily, years after the term of the present narrative, and both were magnificent. The Rennert also offered an oyster pot pie that had its points, but the late Jeff Davis, manager of the hotel and the last public virtuoso of Maryland cookery, once confessed to me that its flavor was really due to a sly use of garlic. Such concoctions as panned and scalloped oysters have never been eaten in my time by connoisseurs, and oyster fritters, always called flitters in Baltimore, are to be had only at free-for-all oyster roast along the wharves. A roasted oyster, if it be hauled off the fire at the exact instant the shell opens, is not to be sniffed at. But getting it down is a troublesome business, for the shell is too hot to be handled without mittens. Despite this inconvenience, there are still oyster roasts in Baltimore on winter Sunday afternoons. Oyster roasts in Baltimore on winter Sunday afternoons, and since the collapse of Prohibition, they have been drawing pretty good houses. When the Elks give one, they hire a militia armory, lay in 1,000 kegs of beer, engage 200 waiters, and prepare for a mob. But the mob is not attracted by the oysters alone. It comes mainly to eat hot dogs, barbecued beef, and sauerkraut, and to wash down these lowly victuals with the beer. Just a little bit longer, and we're going to stop. We're actually going to stop in the middle of this essay, which is unprecedented. But I'm just going to make this go about an hour, and we'll return to our Megan appreciation later. Remember, out of appreciation comes inspiration to drive us through life and to understand what's going on. Appreciation, understanding, gratitude are all closely related things. The great crab cook of the days, and so are the reverses of all those things. The greatest crab cook of the days I remember was Tom McNulty, originally a whiskey drummer, but in the end, sheriff of Baltimore, and the most venerated oyster cook was a cop named Fred. So a couple of cops were the best at the greatest crab cook of the days I remember was Tom McNulty, originally a whiskey drummer, but in the end sheriff of Baltimore, and the most venerated oyster cook was a cop named Fred. Tom's specialty was made by spearing a slice of bacon on a large fork, jamming a soft crab down on it, holding the two over a charcoal brazier until the bacon had melted over the crab, then slapping both upon a slice of hot toast. This tidbit had its points, I assure you, and I never think of it without deploring Tom's too early translation to bliss eternal. Again, just a little of his religious mockery. Fred devoted himself mainly to oyster flitters. The other cops rolled in and snuffled in his masterpieces like cats in catnip. But I never could see much virtue in them. It was always my impression, perhaps an error, that he fried them in curve grease borrowed from the street railways. He was an old-time Model T flatfoot, not much taller than a fire plug, but as big around the middle as a load of hay. At the end of a busy afternoon, he would be spattered from head to foot with blobs of flitter batter and wild grease. You like that wild grease? Again, that's showing the master. Who would think to describe it like that? They would just use the conventional spattered, grease spattered. It was the opinion of my father, as I've recorded, that all the Baltimore beers were poisonous. Again, he very, very common and useful, and a use that one can use oneself. That Baltimore beers, he doesn't say the conventional. He avoids the conventional expression, but not out of some need just to be different for different sake, but because he has something actually better. He doesn't say my dad thought all the Baltimore beers were awful or bad. He says it was the opinion of my father, as I have recorded, that all the Baltimore beers were poisonous. Again, the high-minded, he predicted formally the end of the old republic, right? His Baltimore beers were not just bad, they're poisonous. But he nevertheless kept a supply of them in his house for visiting plumbers, tinners, cellar inspectors, tax assessors, and so on, and for Class D social callers. Again, you can infer the man's politics from the way he writes about this stuff. He's the opposite of the respectable approach. He's pointing out in everything the difference and the distance between what's respectable and what people actually do. So his father thinks these beers are poisonous, but he keeps a stock of them on hand to feed people of the lower orders that he wishes to obviously make a good impression on. It's kind of funny. I find by his bill file that he paid $120 for a case of 24 bottles. His own favorite malt liquor was Anheuser-Busch, But he also made occasional experiments with the other brands that were then beginning to find a national market. Again, this is, as we've talked about other places, we have the rise of the creation and start growth into networks of the electronic media, radio and TV, coming out of a time of wire of cheap papers and wireless and telegraph was all they had, into telephones and cars, and you have the growth of movement of communications and transportation that allows the growth of national networks. And this is one of the things that can become national, and brands can become national. Before then, there wasn't much branding. It was all just local stuff that you would buy like staples in a general store, and you would grow the rest yourself because most of the population were farmers. And that's what they mean. They go into town and they buy coffee, tea, and sugar, you know, stuff that came from the Orient or some exotic location that they couldn't make themselves at home. Everything else would come out of the cows and pigs, and the vegetables out of the garden or the fields, and the fruit that they had, you see. So all this kind of at once over 40, 50, you know, maybe 100 years from 1850 to 1950, just radical changes in the ways that we live. And as we're enjoying him writing about these old times, we can just sort of see little facts about that stuff. With other brands that were beginning to find a national market, like, and that was the thing about Anheuser-Busch and Budweiser out of the middle of the country, just as it kind of it was with cars. There used to be all kinds of different cars produced, and then it settled down into three or four dominant manufacturers. There used to be Duesenbergs and Model Ts and what have you, but only what came at Ford and Chevy and Chrysler were the ones that survived. But there used to be dozens, if not hundreds, of car manufacturers. So it was with all these lagers. They have been locally produced or whatever, but a handful of Miller, Coors, Budweiser dominated nationally, national prominence. Why? Who knows exactly why? But they may have been inoffensive to the largest number or had better distribution networks. But the natural, and then today, now we go back to microbrews. So this is the thing. Even if you look at it spiritually, you go from the development of something that's local and tribal to the growth of something that's global and universal, and then you go back to custom-tailored religion or anything. That's the normal pattern. It can fit religion or anything else. So I say, like, whites would need a benefit from a specificity rather than a Catholicity that lumps them in with all the other people. I mean, unless you prefer something worse to something better. Some of them survived to this day, says Mencken, but the most perished under Prohibition, the most of these brands that were out there. His same bill file shows that on December 27th, 1883, he paid Courtney Farrell and Company, then the favorite fancy grocers of Baltimore, $4 for a gallon of Monticello whiskey. It retails now for from $3 to $3.50 a quart. In those days, it was always straight, for the old-time Baltimoreans regarded blends with great suspicion, though many of the widely advertised brands of Maryland rye were of that character. They drank straight whiskey straight, disdaining both diluents. There's a word I've never seen anywhere else. You see what he means. He means diluents, but it's D-I-L-U-E-N-T-S, and chases. They drank straight whiskey straight, disdaining both diluents and chases. I don't recall ever seeing my father drink a highball. The thing must have existed in his day, for he lived on to 1899, but he probably regarded its use as unmanly and ignoble. See, already we've just done a few pages, and he's used a version of noble twice. Before every meal, including breakfast, he ducked into the cupboard in the dining room and poured out a substantial hooker of rye. And when he emerged, he was always sucking in a great whiff of air to cool off his tonsils. Again, the beautifulness of the description. You can see what's going on from the way he says it. And he doesn't describe it in an ordinary way, but in an extraordinary way. Ordinary thing in an extraordinary and picturesque way. He said that it was the best medicine he'd ever found for toning up his stomach. Anyway, that's the bottom of page 8. Let's just leave it there because we've been going for an hour, and I have to run some errands today. But, my favorite, my inspiration, someone whose works produced endless pleasure from reading, and not just pleasure, but actual understanding of how to write from a technical point of view, but from a more general way for the non-writer, how to think, how to look at things, how to appreciate them, how to laugh, how to see the difference between what is and what is claimed. And surely that's one of the, that's an intellectual Swiss Army knife, wouldn't you say? There's fits any application. It's a skeleton key. Everything you do, there's going to be a difference between what's claimed and what is. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll go over more of this, and we'll do a bunch of other books beside. VNN Forum, Alex Linder, The Linder Files, and talk to you again.